Hello, Bob.
Yes, Ben. Glad to be back.
This is our 24th hour together.
Great.
And we've often talked about Finnegan's Wake on this show, and it occurred to me just now that we do approach Finnegan's Wake very differently. I mean, it's a relief to talk to someone who thinks of Finnegan's Wake as relevant to understanding anything and everything in the modern world, however whizzy and new it is. But what I wanted to explore was the difference in our approaches to it, because I saw Finnegan's Wake, I was alerted to it by my older brother, who, growing up, was the youngest in my family. I was a bit of a smart aleck, and my older brother saw me a bit intimidating because I was so quick to pick up on all the stuff they're talking about and echoing it back and being bright. And my older brother joked to my mother, oh yeah, Ben's read all of James Joyce. And I immediately said to my mother, well, who's this James Joyce? Because I could see it was some sort of bone of contention whether or not you read James Joyce. And she looked very disapproving and said, oh, a very difficult writer, never mind about that. So I immediately thought Joyce sounded interesting and forbidden. So I went to the school library and found Joyce, and there was a big thick book called Finnegan's Wake. And the first one I pulled out was the thickest one, Finnegan's Wake. I pulled it out and I found it wasn't written in English. It was written in smashed up words that reminded me of Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll, which was my favourite poem. And I immediately thought, this book is absolutely fantastic. And I borrowed it and I started reading out sentences to everybody I met. And I remember one classical scholar saying very early on, there's some coax, 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 which is from The Frogs by Aristophanes. And I had absolutely no idea it was a classical reference, but they were very contemptuous and said, oh, everybody uses that passage from Aristophanes. It's such a cliche. And I just thought coax, coax, coax written across the page was really amazing and exciting in a book. So I had an immediate response to it. I liked it. It didn't worry me that one couldn't take away a meaning and know what it was. It was just the fact that it immersed you in this sea of languages and jokes and liveliness just seemed great. Whereas you, I believe, approach Finnegan's Wake more from what Marshall McLuhan said about it. And I find when you quote from it, you quote sentences of coherent explanation about the modern world, a modern world that's only arrived after Joyce's time, which I find quite astonishing. And I really like it, to have Finnegan's Wake explained in this more theoretical way. But I was just wondering about whether ever the idea of immersing yourself in its language, kind of getting drunk on its language, has ever appealed to you, or you've always approached it in this rather more analytical way, like using it as a guide to modern media.
Okay, how old were you when you encountered the Wake? Were you in high school?
I was about 13.
Yeah, that's very early. For then, maybe now people would notice it more. Kids can find out all kinds of things faster, but that's pretty precocious to start looking and reading it.
Well, I told you why I was being precocious. I mean, it was kind of, my family was kind of, even by trying to discourage me, they were leading me towards it, because I could see that James Joyce was this big cultural question that you could either master or not, and there was a big issue, you know, and my brother was frightened of it, so obviously I wanted to get it. But my surprise was that I found it so immediately attractive. I didn't find it off-putting, and I wasn't particularly bright at school. I was having terrible problems with Latin. I learned Latin for 8 years and never got anywhere with it. It was frightening teachers and talk about grammar, and you know, there were plenty of subjects which were intimidating me, but I think I could smell in Finnegan's Wake an end to intimidation.
Now, if you were 13, that's 1968.
Yeah,
very interesting. So I, as a young man, when I was 13, I met Joyce, but I'm not going to go into that, through my father in Paris. My father knew all these people, and there were a reason why he looked for them.
So, yeah, well, do go into that. It's an interesting story. People might feel a little bit disappointed if you're not going to go into that.
Well, I could go to my website and read you the diary entries.
Okay, well, if it's there, it's there. Yeah, okay. People can find that.
Go to fivebody.com and look up what's called the Android Meme Xenocrony Diaries, and the very first entry from April 22nd, 1935 is my encounter with Joyce through my father. But my father, what was interesting is my father was part of a group that read Finnegan's Wake when it was in transition. in the 20s and 30s.
This is before it was published as Finnegan's Wake, when it used to be known as a work in progress.
Yeah, so he was a butler for a very wealthy family in Paris, and he met with these people, which were interesting people themselves. You could say they were intelligence agents, and they were interested in what Joyce, because Joyce had gotten attention with Ulysses, and now he was writing Garble. What the hell happened to him? You know, starting in 1924, 25, 26, when he started publishing excerpts. And eventually, mainly in Transition magazine.
Well, I mean, it was published in 1939, so it's just before the outbreak of the Second World War. And he was investigated by the British Secret Service in case it was a code book for the Germans to use, wasn't he?
Yes.
Do you know about that? I mean, he was cleared. Yeah. They found that it wasn't a code book for the Germans, so it wasn't banned.
No, basically, he had so many censorship problems with Finnegan's, with Ulysses, that on one level you could say he wrote the Wake that way so that nobody could see what he was doing, and he couldn't get nailed for it. You know, that's a one level to look at it. So they would. So my father would come home from these sessions, and I was just 10, say, and I always knew he had a session with these people, because for about the next 24 hours he'd call me Tim Finnegan. All right.
Yeah.
Cool. And I didn't know what he was talking about, but I knew he was kind of drunk on it. You know,
yeah.
They were just, and the reason they were looking at it is that these intelligence agents on their desk were reports from all over the world in different languages. And then here's Finnegan's a writing called Work in Progress, collaging languages from different cultures on each page. That was a direct mirror of the experience of these intelligence people. So they were wondering why Joyce was doing this.
Yeah, I mean, in my own background, I have an element of this, because my father was brought up bilingually in Brazil, talking English and Portuguese. He learnt Welsh at a very young age, got interested in obscure and difficult languages, and ended up mastering tens of languages. He ended up in Chinese scholarship as kind of the most difficult language you can think of to master, and Japanese and Russian and Sanskrit and Pali, and he loved mastering languages. And he worked for British intelligence during the war, trying to break codes. He was in India of the Japanese were using, and he was the guy who knew Japanese to help with decoding. And But he didn't respond to Finnegan's Wake at all. And my enthusiasm in Finnegan's Wake, he found very disturbing, because he was very into the correctness of an interpretation of mastering a language. And suddenly I was having an enthusiasm with something that was obviously using all the words and languages in the world, but from a poetic or a loose point of view, where was the correctness? He couldn't find it. So it's interesting that you're talking with intelligence agents that could see the point of something like Finnegan's Wake, whereas my father couldn't, and part of my Oedipal rebellion was to hang on to Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, because these people were international intelligence agencies, not national. He's a nationalist. He's being an efficient bureaucrat helping Britain against the Nazis or Japanese or something.
That's right,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The guys that my father worked with were the ones who caused World War I and World War II, the ones who profited from it. They were on a totally different level. You know what I mean? But it was like, hey, here's this famous author. He's got a new book out. What is it? You go look at the book, and it's a picture of you. This is how these guys, this guy is showing our experience. Why is he doing this? Has he infiltrated us? You know what I mean? He's showing a picture of my desk. It was that shocking to him. It's like if Zappa put an album out and I run to the store and there's a picture of me on the cover, I would be shocked, right? If I had no connection to Zappa. It was like that. So I knew of Joyce as a person that my father was involved in, didn't know, wasn't interested in anything. But when I had to spy on McLuhan in 54, 55, eventually he would talk about Joyce. And what I remember him telling me...
Hang on, Bob, I want to ask you a vulgar question that I can't stand it when people ask me this vulgar question, because of meeting Frank Zappa. People always say to me, well, come on, tell us, what was he like? And I kind of cringe and say, well, I've written about meeting him and I've done all I can and I can't give you a little extra fame thing. But I do want to ask you, what was Joyce like to you as a 10-year-old?
I met James Joyce, Ezra Pound at different times, and T.S. Eliot, Aleister Crowley, who else in there? Yeats, Aldous Huxley, all these people my father sort of
Was Joyce
out.
Blind
every,
by then?
Every one of them. every one of them, and you can read in my diaries, triggered a psychic effect in me. I saw an image. I can't remember what I saw with Joyce. Well, I think I saw, here's what I saw.
Did Brancusi get close? Do you know the Brancusi drawing of Joyce? It's on the cover of Richard Ellman's, one of the paperback of Richard Ellman's biography, and it's like three vertical lines and a spiral. And from the photographs, I think it really gets Joyce's long face and the round glasses. Do you know that by Brancusi, the Romanian abstract sculptor and artist?
Yes, and actually that's appropriate, because I remember looking at Joyce. I'm just a kid, but I got a psychic whammy from it. Like, there was something so powerful coming off these people, or different, that it triggered my psychic gland. And so I hallucinated or saw an image of something when I met these people. With Joyce, I saw this word, Banook, B-A-N-O-O-K, and I didn't know what it was. And years later, I decided, well, maybe it means ban the book.
Mm.
But then when I was in Nova Scotia in Canada, there was a paddling club called Banook.
Ah.
B-A-N-O-O-K.
So it's about paddling.
That's what I had seen. But he had triggered it. But so I didn't know what it was.
So he's saying, go paddle in the waters of life.
Maybe that. I think it's just that they were so, they emanated some kind of power or charisma or uniqueness that my young mind would spiral off it. And that image you're saying of the coverage, that's what it was. He was like, it's almost like I don't remember him as a person. He was an effect. These people were effects on me. So us, and what was he like? I don't know. I never, the last time I saw Joyce was in 1939, and I was 17. And I was still a kid, so I don't know what they were like.
Yeah,
but I'll tell you this.
He was blind by then. Was he blind? Do you remember him being blind?
I remember him being odd.
Yeah.
I mean, he had the eye patch on and that. I probably assumed he was, but it was non-physical. It was a psychic interaction. One thing, people might want to know what McLuhan was like. McLuhan was a jerk. Very irritating to be around, at least when you first encountered him. So if people want to know what he was like, for me. But anyways, here's what happened. Is it very early in the mid-50s when I started talking to McLuhan, and I was pretending to be interested in his work, and I was for other reasons, but not on the aesthetic stuff. And I knew nothing about America. I just come here, came from Paris. I didn't know R&B or anything. And he told me that Finnegan's Wake was a radio program, not a book. So you have to realize it's the first instance, really, that I heard the idea consciously. Joyce said something similar in 1939 to me, and you can read the diary entry, and that's a diary entry based on a memory like 10 years later. I didn't write it down when I was 17, but then I remembered it as close as I can in the 1950, writing it down. So he said something like that, but McLuhan was the first where I told
him. Well,
it.
I mean, so the thing that Joyce said that sounds like, if I could just footnote that for listeners, that sounds like that to me, is he said he couldn't understand people having difficulties with Finnegan's Wake. He said, just read it out loud.
Okay, that's not what Joyce said to me, but what McLuhan said was similar. He said that Finnegan's Wake was not a book, it was a radio program. Now, I had no clue what that meant, and I never pursued it at all. I was aware of the Wake, but in my life I was running around as a harassed bureaucrat in the intelligence world, and I wasn't concerned about aesthetics or anything. But in 1968, same year as you, War and Peace in the Global Village came out, and I was tracking McLuhan's books, and in that book it's riddled with quotes from Finnegan's Wake in the margins. That's the first time I started actually reading quotes of Finnegan's Wake.
I see. And so it's quotes chosen by McLuhan that are directly about what you're thinking about. So you're taking it as analytical concepts coming from Finnegan's Wake.
Right. He would put in the margins a quote to illustrate what he was saying in the center column of his prose.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So it was marginalia illustrated. So, and then he has the Ten Thunders of Finnegan's Wake outlined in that book. So I enter Finnegan's Wake through technology or through McLuhan's model. Okay, I'm not doing it verbally. So by 1975, I decided to actually read the book rather than thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about how McLuhan talked about it and the few quotes that I knew. So I read the whole thing through. And, you know,
if it's 1975, are you reading Finnegan's Wake while listening to One Size Fits All by Frank Zappa?
Yes, yes. I'm listening to Zappa. I'm with Zappa. I'm listening to Beefheart, listening to Bonzo Dog, Doodah Band, whatever they're called, Fire Sun Theater, all kinds of things. But the thing was, as I read through it, and I remember reading through it and noticing things, but at the end, I didn't know what I'd read. It didn't mean anything to me. So then I got Eric McLuhan's thesis in 1983, his PhD thesis, and that emphasized the Ten Thunders. So that, again, sort of showed me how to approach it through the technology model of McLuhan, which is not the aesthetic appreciation of the letting it wash over, enjoying the verbality of it. Oh. But then in 1985 to 1987, Roland McHugh's annotations came out so I could look at meanings. All right, he had the top three interpretations of the critics of each line. You know that book, Roland McHugh's annotations. So I would read a page a day and read every word and look at the meanings and think about what McLuhan said about it and actually get into the music of it. And then when I was in New York City, I went through the whole book for a couple of years in the 80s. And then in New York, I was a member of the Finney's Wake Society of New York, and we went through every line, and we went through, like, I was there for 93 to 2000, so for 7 years I'm doing the Wake in depth with people who are enjoying the music of it. So in that way I got through the verbal stuff, but every time when I left the group or when I walked home or thought about it later, I always thought, well, what's the point of this? And I thought about how McLuhan said he was applying Joyce. So for me, I found the technological model was the best way to tell people about it who normally would hear from the regular Joes who read Finney's Wake, who'd say, well, it's great verbal fun and play. To me, that was limiting.
That sells it short.
Intrigue people.
That sells it short, and that's kind of the thoughts that are coming up in my mind, were that I don't quite want to say, well, it's a verbal bath. I want you to paddle in it and slosh around in it in a vague sort of way, because I think the enjoyment you get from the Wake, or what it does to you, is slightly more precise than that. And probably because I don't believe that responding to music is in fact a laying back and letting something wash over you. In fact, that response to music, which is David Toop's Ocean of Sound book, the idea you lie on your sofa, this kind of decadent Wagnerian, you know, you're sniffing perfumes and this music wafts over you, is actually the opposite of the excitement that I get from music, which is an idea of relief when something's correct, which all the things which are incorrect or have been worrying you about music flake off. And so for me, the idea of choosing which music you like as against all the music which doesn't move you and seems to be constructed wrongly is crucial. And therefore, when you're responding to what Finnegan's Wake does to you, I don't think it's simply washing over you. It's also washing off a lot of what you haven't been enjoying about reading books, which is their inability to express what it's like to actually read a book. And at random, I have a sentence in front of me, and it says, we want Bud, we want Bud Buddily, we want Bud Buddily Bodily. And that for me is Finnegan's Wake, that it voices the experience of my whole body in sitting down to read a book, and doesn't just speak at a level of concepts which are clicking into some preconceived conceptual pattern I have in my head, which a lot of books in fact do. They trigger, whether we're talking about a very simple romance designed for female readers, which just goes click click about fantasies about handsome doctors or whatever the genre of romance is, or in fact books which are considered very difficult philosophy, which in fact repeat back to people the philosophical jargon they've already mastered and merely go round again. That Finnegan's Wake is continually, because of its, and this is my argument about music, that one's response to music is it's something sub-conceptual. It's not your mind, it's your body responding to the music. But to be able to recognize that, your body twanging to it, is akin to a psychoanalysis or an understanding of where your body is, which is removing a repression which is normally there. And therefore it's a delicate operation and a very specific operation.
And what you just said again is stating what I felt. The washing over in the music sense of Finney's Wake, I always thought that wasn't the point. That was a subset and a relaxation point. But that's why I liked our Finnegan's Wake group, because we would analyze every word and figure out the puns and all that. And that, it stopped, Finnegan's Wake stopped you just having a normal prose experience. And because of McLuhan, I knew that it was communicating the whole body. And then I would add, though, the extensions of the body, the media. So your way you're describing the wake is what I was always trying to advocate. And my way of doing it was to get them out of the musical cliche response and to point a whole other level of looking at it. And so I had the same motive as you did.
But I turn it around and say that cliched musical response is selling music itself short, because I don't think music is something that washes over you, that Beethoven is writing something very specific and for a purpose to alert you to society and your body and your relationship to the cosmos, which is not, it may get turned into just pretty music which washes over you, but that's not the intent of any important music.
No, exactly, and that's what I meant. I'm referring to, you know, when you read the average populist presentation of the wake, they say just enjoy the music of it.
Yeah.
Just babble away. And that's how I read it in 1975. I just was reading through, I didn't know what it was, I had no annotations or anything. I wasn't gonna be running looking up every word, so I just sort of went through and just noticed whatever glimpsed at me. That I knew was not appropriate. And so I used McLuhan to get people not to assume that cliche. And in the Finnegan's Wake group, there was always new people coming, and they'd always be befuddled by it, and they'd always say, well, I'm just going to let it wash over me. And then I'd jump in and say, no, that's not the way to do it. And then I'd irritate most people, because they thought, well, yeah, that's what we're doing. We're letting it wash over us. That is that's why Joyce said, the eyes demand their turn, let them be seen. He wanted you to see music.
And this is the consciousness that, for me, the great music that I think is pertinent to our times. And this is why I think music criticism is a very political act and creates a lot of conflict around where music criticism is published and what's allowed to be said. That it isn't simply a matter of these people like this and those people like that and they should be serviced. I think there's very little music at one time which is really important and is doing something that matters. And that music, I think, in its very detail, is talking about everything all the time. That every note choice that's happening in this pertinent music I'm talking about is exploding error and making points about different areas of life and expressing anger and joy at all kinds of very specific moments of the life that we're all in. And it's that truth which worries people and is often considered to be the noisy horribleness of modern music, whereas in fact it's pertinence to you. And that there's a relationship between, this is why it doesn't, can't just wash over you, because every grain of it has in it a picture of something which is communicating a position and a determinate angle on things.
That's exactly what the wake does. So when there were so many arts that were attempting that in the 100 years ago, pointing out what you're doing, and so I didn't want people to turn Finnegan's Wake into a fetish and stay there. But it was the most comprehensive thing to make the point you just made in so many different ways you could use the wake. So I applied the wake to point out what was happening now, and I did not want to fetishize the wake. So the wake was...
By fetishize, you mean sort of become just a Finnegan's Wake scholar or somebody who just told everybody they got to read this great work of literature, which actually does it a disservice, because then great literature becomes bigger than Finnegan's Wake and it becomes merely an illustration of the idea of great literature and you're not really taking the book seriously, whereas to apply it, to take it out of simply reading Finnegan's Wake to claiming that it's an analysis of media as you do, is really to read the book.
Yes, and I think that's what... I think people can understand that Joyce was satirizing those that wanted to make a big deal out of the book. So they don't even get, as we encountered in London last April, or a year ago, that group fetishizing every little thing and missing the point, missing at least one of the agendas of Finnegan's Wake. I think he includes all the agendas including the scholarship, but he definitely makes fun of scholarship or turning the book into something that he was critiquing that tendency all the time. So
which is why, I mean, like Frank Zappa's music, I find that the person who knows nothing about it, you read out a sentence to them and you find out more than if you go and ask an expert. And then I fall just by random. I've got it open here. We are once or more as babes are wandering in a world made fresh, where with the hen and the story boot, we start from scratch.
Yeah.
So we're babes in the wood. It's trying to get at that infantile experience of wonder and what things are in which you actually experience and actually look at stuff rather than already knowing what it is and fitting it into your preconceived patterns.
Right. The Phineas Wake Society people thought it was absurd that I would be on New York radio or TV talking about Phineas Wake with people who never heard of it, never even knew what it was. They thought you had to read the book and understand it. And I was given the clue to, in other words, I was presenting it to people who didn't know anything about it, like you're presenting Zappa.
This That's reminds me of a debate I've had in email this week with a writer for The Wire called Sam Davies, who I criticized in an article I wrote for a book on noise called Noise and Capitalism, put together by an editor called Matin, and I criticised him for changing his mind about a band called Ascension, who I reckon are doing, when I was talking about the detail being critical and mattering, I was thinking of Stefan Jurvetson's guitar playing in the band Ascension. And Sam Davies, I've lost. Get back to what you were saying, Bob.
I would bring up Phineas Wake to people like you did.
Who and that's got me back on track. Thank you. That Sam Davies was saying, I have studied modern music. I have now got to a stage where I can understand Ascension's music because I've gone and listened to Pierre Boulez and to Cecil Taylor, and I've mastered it. And I just felt this is so wrong, that modern music is not something that you accrete like a positive culture which you own. It's actually a shedding of culture so that you can get to something direct. It's learning how to rid yourself. That may be a discipline, and it may be you're helped by other people who've done music and so on. I'm not saying you don't use anything, but I'm saying that this idea of accumulating a positive sort of culture, which then allows you to appreciate these high works, is based upon the old way of doing culture. It's pre-modernist. This is the classical view of the accumulation of knowledge, and it's not appropriate for responding to things like Ascension sorry, that was my microphone falling off this apparatus I have. I have a chopstick attached with a piece of masking tape on top of my computer, and it just fell down, obviously, responding to my idea of unmediation.
Response to your complaint.
Yeah. But do you feel that about how we should respond to modern media and the kind of interventions that are exciting in it that we agree with, that it's against this idea of building up slowly a culture which we master, and it's actually seeking to shatter that so that we can get to some more direct communication with other people?
Yeah, what you were describing is the literate Encyclopedia Britannica effect of the printing press phase. That's the classic mode.
And the boringness of people who claim to be music writers, of experts, of, you know, I mean, I just groan when I hear that someone's an expert on jazz. I always think, actually, this person doesn't understand jazz at all. You know, because the person who really understands jazz actually is triggered by jazz to become their own creative vortex, that they become somebody who can look at things, and therefore of relevance to them will be the mad music that their uncle used to play on the organ when they were 10 years old. Now, if somebody starts talking to me about that, I know I'm talking to someone who really will tell me something about music. Whereas if I talk to someone who says they've mastered jazz, I know I'm talking to an idiot.
Yeah, using McLuhan's framework, the literate person, the classical tradition, is that your receptacle, passive receptacle, accumulating conceptual categories and data and labels, okay? Whereas a tactile approach to music, you're describing a tactile approach, not an acoustic expertise, but a tactile approach, where I don't know what I'm going to like today, And I wouldn't categorize what I liked 2 months ago. I can turn on a Cow Seal song, and if I'm in a certain response, I'll like it. Next day, I won't like it. I don't know what I'm going to like.
And there is what is interesting, there is a determinate reason why you like or dislike it. I'm not arguing for a kind of relativistic nihilism in which we just throw up our hands and say, oh, well, let's just get on with it, and no one can understand why you like or dislike. There are reasons why suddenly a window opens up in different kinds of music at different times in your life or on different days or in different moments, which are very specific, and that you can tell people and you can communicate. I mean, I wouldn't like people to think that we're both getting on a thing of just getting rid of reflection and analysis, but I think we need to confess a lot more our very personal ways in and ways round, which would actually make writing rather more interesting if people revealed where they came from when they're talking, instead of adopting a kind of dry expertise which aims towards some kind of objectivity. Which isn't objective. Real objectivity has to state what position you're coming from. I mean, this is Einstein's point, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't judge my breathing. I don't judge my breathing. Absorbing information, music, and that is like breathing. And I might start thinking about my breathing or meditating on it, but I'm not going to stay with any definite concepts. I've never learned anything from music. I've never accumulated any experience, but I know what I'm going to like. And I have to cancel that statement. I don't know what I'm going to like.
Yeah.
But I do know what I responded to. And I find that something I responded to a couple years ago, I don't respond to now. Like Zappa, I come in and out of.
Yeah.
But I always find in the long run, Zappa still, he always is powerful.
But Bob, I always enjoy on these programs saying the absolute opposite of what you've just said and then finding how you may or may not agree with it. And in a way, I think all I've ever learned from is music. That Finnegan's Wake, I absorbed as music because I got on with the process of getting through it before I stalled at understanding or not understanding the detail, and the process of going through it becomes something which expresses a point of view which then allows you to look at the details. But until you've got that, you can't speak about it. And this immersion in a process and a moving attitude, that the movement from one word to another and the pronunciation of it, of learning that the sound of it has to be in your mind as you read it. You don't have to read it out loud in order to understand it, but unless you're aware of what the sound and the look, all these different things that you can apply to the word are, then you're not going to be able to grasp it. So this thing of entering the process of it before you set up the gates to absorbing this idea as true or that idea as untrue, this having to dive into it, into the river, before, you know, that you have to get your feet wet, you have to paddle.
Right, and McLuhan said that Joyce and the other greats communicate before the reader's understanding.
Mm.
So you're responding to what's communicated. Now, here's what I meant by...
And then you need help. Then you need help from other people to explain why you like it so much. I mean, for me, the pertinent art that I respond to, I really like it, and I'm convinced it's really important. And then I'm floundering around to explain why, and often I need to go to other people and talk about it in order to kind of recover myself. And I want someone to tell me why I like it. I go out looking for explanations, and that's the community that arises. Why so often the pertinent art is like a filter for filtering out the ninnies and the twits, so that you don't need to communicate with them, so you find the right people so that they can start to explain yourself to yourself.
Right, now that's exactly what I was going to say a minute ago this way. When I say I don't learn anything from music or anything that inspires me or does something to me, it frees me from my learning, from my concepts. And that's why you go around trying to naturally reconceptualize what you've been liberated from.
Mm. Yeah, and it's that openness to the parts of your being which are not conceptual are going to respond, that listening to them, which is why it's like psychoanalysis, why it has this progressive criticism of the repressive sociality that is based upon biting your tongue and sitting on your hands and not acting and being bored, waiting for your chance to bore everybody else, which is what most culture seems to consist of.
Yeah, so the categories of experience that the mind naturally creates, great art liberates you from that, not to put down the conceptualization that natural, there's a natural time lag in a person's consciousness.
Yeah.
What actually music does, I learn nothing from it, but then after the experience, I start learning better or more the concepts.
Well, it's
and
like
then I go back to the music or to Zappa to unlearn what I did to fill in after the first experience.
But this is where communication starts for me. That there is no real communication in the kind of squabbles between people who like different musics. We're not communicating, we're having battles. I mean, this is the reason why when I was younger, and even now, I don't like politics, where people have stuck positions and then they hurl shit at each other until somebody's piled the other person in more shit than the other. I mean, this is what I felt when I met Wynton Marsalis, for example. I was quite shocked. I was used to meeting musicians from jazz, people like Billy Bang and people that Lee's Jazz put on, and you'd meet them and fundamentally you'd simply have this companionship of, we are both supporting this wonderful music that not many people have heard of, and it's quite hard and there's not much money in it. How are we going to, you know, improve the situation? And you'd talk to them and work with them on that problem. When I went to Marsalis, I met somebody from a completely different angle. I met someone, it was like talking to a politician. He was out to prove me wrong. He was out to prove me a bourgeois, you know, and it was like, reminded me of debates, political debates at school or something, you know, outwitting your opponent. And it was just shocking for me. But when I thought about it, I thought, well, this is not the area of culture that matters, that you've got to have the experience yourself before you apply the concepts. And it's getting that in the wrong order, which seems to me to explain a lot of what's wrong with education, that it's the results of experience, the analysis, but without the experience, so that people have to take on trust that all this stuff is true, which is why it's very important for teachers to actually give experience to their students. Just a small example. In Bradford, there was a teacher who took some of the art students under, they were teaching to a morgue and had them put their fingers in the vagina of a dead woman. And I thought that was a very intelligent teacher, because that teacher was giving them an experience for then the reflection and so on. It wasn't simply a lurid stunt. It was designed to force them into something which they hadn't considered before, so that they would all begin talking to each other and actually learning. And that is crucial. Without that, everything is just dry as dust oppression.
Yeah, you often refer to Mingus and people like him who didn't like the term jazz. Wynton Marsalis is running around within the Android Meme conditions of the 80s and 90s, hoiking up the concept of jazz and representing it.
Yeah, well, he was completely part of the niche marketing commodification of music of the 1980s, and he was a spokesman riding that, much like a yuppie entrepreneur riding the crest of dot-com, you know, investment or something, you know, talking up a storm for this particular area that we can provide a political justification for, and without any real love of what the music can do to people. You know, it was like a demonstration.
Like all those other books on Zappa.
I mean, I have to say, I do have some Wynton Marsalis albums. There were moments when I quite enjoy it as a kind of very brittle, show-off, shiny reproduction of a certain style. There's a certain charm in it, and when he goes, uses the blues, there's a certain incongruity between his classicizing precision and the blues, and there are certain aspects of his music which are fairly enjoyable, but it's as a ideological spokesman that the whole thing comes crashing down.
Well, 2 points. I wanted to say that what you're describing, this commodification, like all those other books on Zappa, they're victims of that. And what's interesting about your book is that you showed your response to Zappa, which had nothing to do with Zappa, but it had all this mastery of Western culture, sort of, in quotes. Mm. References that people say, well, that has nothing to do with Frank. Well, that's not the point. This is Ben's response to Frank.
Are you talking about the people who kind of are selling their privy information. I mean, I suppose the Barry Miles book is the perfect example of that, with someone who was it claims on the back of the book that he was there for the session for Hot Rats, although that's not something you can actually find in the book, which for selling to an English audience is, you know, the way to sell it. You know, it's the most famous Frank Zappa record. Here was somebody who was there when it was recorded. This must be the key to this puzzling oeuvre. and people selling their insider tips, you know, that they've seen that. And I was forced, because of my position, to approach Zappa as I'm somebody in a different country. The records are coming out, I love them, but you know, as to being part of the court circle, I'm obviously excluded. You know, I have to write in paranoid isolation.
Well, you don't want to be a member of it. Those people like Miles, in the end, write books that put down Zappa.
And Barry Miles hates Zappa. The whole thing is an assassination. He does a moral critique all about, he can't bear Zappa's openness about sex. He thinks Zappa's cynical and accuses him of procuring prostitutes for the band. And he's kind of disgusted with Frank and can't really understand why the music works or what makes you sit up and listen when you hear the records. He has no response to the disjunctures in the music. I mean, if you don't like the sudden changes and the gaps that open up for you on a Frank Zappa record, I mean, what are you listening to? It's just, you know, it's mad to write a book about him.
Right, and so when I had the chance to meet Wynton Marsalis, I did my music test on him. I said, what do you think of Frank Zappa?
And he said, no, I prefer Yes. Did he? Because I know Bramford, his brother, they all went to see Yes in New Orleans, and they loved it, which for me was an absolute illustration of the fact that they can't hear music.
That's right. No, hey, Wynton Marsalis said he never heard Zappa's music. He hardly knew of him.
Right, yeah.
So then I knew he was a man out of his time.
Yeah.
He was in the past.
Yeah.
He didn't, not to be a musician today and not confront and deal with Zappa, in a way, that's inexcusable, but people have the right to do it.
And you can, and it's not like everyone in jazz is in this position. I mean, Frank Kofsky, who wrote one of the best books on John Coltrane, he interviewed Frank Zappa, you know, back in 69 for...
67.
67.
The first interview with Zappa I read in Jazz and Pop.
Exactly. You know, so all these things unite. And this is what I discovered when I did work as a jazz journalist. To my surprise, I found that always when I talked to really good musicians, they were sophisticated about genre, or they weren't stuck in genre, and that they... Often, if I mention Zappa, would just say, what, you know, amazingly interesting music. They'd put it like that. And they weren't bothered with all these categories which show that music isn't for them. And then I realized that's a consumer problem. That's the marketing divides people up into, this is my identity. And we've talked on these programs about how we are into the non-identity politics, that we find identities actually is a subscription to the marketing system which defines consumers, and that
leads into Facebook. But before, I have one more story on what we're just saying immediately. Gary Giddens interviewed, I remember this like 25, 30 years ago, I think it was Gary Giddens, one of the Village Voice jazz critics, interviewed, went over to Cecil Taylor's home and was looking at his record collection and was shocked that he had James Brown and all this stuff that wasn't jazz in his collection. The critic, the expert, was shocked.
Yeah. Yeah, I once wrote...
to Facebook.
Yeah, I wrote a poem about that once, about Cecil Taylor listens to Marvin Gaye. But then I said, but Mr. Gaye, do you check out Cecil, old smoothie chops?
Okay, yeah, that's Frank's question.
Yeah.
That is what Frank meant when he said, I have questions for the culture. Yes, he is. Mr. Gay, do you check out Cecil Taylor?
Yeah.
And usually they don't.
Yeah. Well, it's the interesting one, isn't it?
Because they're one-sided, the successful.
Yeah. But this is very much, we are talking over the oeuvre of Frank Zappa, because we proceed from the point of view is that we can't stand people who don't check everything out and see whether they like it or not. We're not saying they have to like everything, are we? We just want a response, the one that isn't prejudiced by saying that area of culture is not for me.
Yes, but do you listen to Rush Limbaugh?
Do you listen to?
Rush Limbaugh.
Well, what is Rush Limbaugh? I never heard of it. Play me some.
I don't know.
Do you listen to Yanku Dumitrescu, Bob?
Yes, and you played me. Was that what you played me?
That was what I was playing you earlier.
Yeah, yes, that for the first time. That's why I listened to your Out to Lunch show, because I'm going to hear stuff that I haven't had time to find.
Yeah, well, tell me, though, what this thing that you're referring to now is.
Rush Limbaugh is the famous founder of right-wing talk radio.
Oh, I see. Right. And so you're stretching music to mean absolutely everything.
Yes. Talking about experiencing, looking into all kinds of things.
Of course, one needs to check everything out. I would never say anything is evil or tainted or that if I touch it, it's going to turn me to stone. I mean, I need to...
Well, I bet you're limited by the medium. You have not listened to my other self that does cash flow. You haven't checked the other parts of me.
Well, there are... I mean, I don't stop thinking because of this openness to what things are. And I certainly... I'm also believe in no platform for fascists. So I'm quite prepared to pull the chair out from underneath people saying certain things which I think destroy democratic discourse. And I'm not an absolute libertarian to the point of tolerating fascism, no, but that probably is an issue for discussion elsewhere. But yeah,
you actually turn this thing that you must listen to everything and explore everything into a political program, an agenda.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, the idea of getting rid of agendas. No, but the idea of getting agendas and pretending to be is liberalism, you know, and actually it's from a very comfortable and powerful and in place politics. It's justifying what is and saying, well, I can check everything because nothing really matters. So I'm not coming from that point of view.
Yeah, and that's important to make that. And I never know what I like. I'm going to turn on and listen to something and be amazed I like something that I definitely didn't like 20 years ago. So I do not know what I like. What's that famous line? People don't know about art, but they know what they like.
Yeah, it's the defense of philistinism and ignorance is saying, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. And Theodore Adorno turned around and said, no, you like what you know.
Right, and I don't know what I know, and I don't know what I like, so I'm available to listen to anything.
Well, I definitely don't like what I know. What I know is miserable and needs to be changed. Yeah.
Say it again, you definitely...
I definitely don't like what I know already, and it's partial and limited and patchy and needs to be completely changed by the transforming fire of the Bob and Ben revolution, of course.
Yes, so let's go into Facebook, which we were talking last week on how... Gamma was lost in Facebook, and I wanted to explore that. What is it about Facebook that Esther is complaining about?
Maybe I should explain to listeners a bit that Gamma's my total inspiration here in London. He's my my Finnegan's Wake of the Soul. I go and talk to him, and he word surfs, and he makes me feel right. And for the last five or six years, he's been my complete support. I met him drinking on a park bench, and I took bottles of wine, and he can read my books without taking them the wrong way. His line is he likes my language, and I love it when he says that. And I can make him recite my poetry, and when he recites my poetry, he answers his phone and just carries on reciting my ridiculous poetry to whoever phones him up. So I adore Gamma, and he's been my great support. He used to phone me twice a week, and he'd always phone me after my radio show and comment on it, and didn't always like it. Sometimes he'd criticize it, but not, you know, he's usually enthusiastic, and he'd go off at tangents and make me feel it was worth doing the radio programs. And recently, no phone calls. And then I find from people who do Facebook, he's Facebooking, Gamma's Facebooking. He's relating everybody to everybody and everything to everything. So Gamma has a whole Facebook thing going on, so I hardly ever hear from him. I did get a call from him today, which my partner Esther took, and then I rang him up, but then I interrupted him and doing something, and so it was a brief conversation. So I'm still in touch, but I've lost my friend Gamma to Facebook, which makes me think about Facebook. But what makes me not keen to dive into Facebook myself is reports from my partner who spies on Facebook without actually doing it. And she says that some of the wonderful people we know, and she was thinking of Marco Morizzi, the extraordinary Zappologist and critical mind in Rome, everything's nicey-nicey, that Marco's Facebook is domestic, and it's all chitter-chatter about how I went on a nice holiday for 3 days and I've been cooking minestrone lately, and it's all so benign. And she's saying, where's the edge? Where's the Marco we adore who proves that George Romero is the only filmmaker worth watching, and unless you're making a zombie film, you should die? You know, where's that Marco gone? And that is her experience, her comment on Facebook, that somehow it's networking has introduced an insidious lack of debate and a lack of pride, so that people are just like, come into my Facebook and look at these, my pictures of my family. Everything's become showing pictures of your family to each other, and we all share. And where's, and this is why I created a thing on our website called The Artwork, because I decided we've got to have things which are called artworks where we proudly say, this is it, folks. This is my statement, and you can hang it in your ass. This is what I'm saying. And then people can come along and say, no, I completely disagree with this. But that's where the argument gets heated and high and proud and interesting. And if everybody's just being nice to each other, I think the level of the culture just dribbles down to the lowest common polite boringness. Okay. Now, without knowing anything about Facebook, that's my view on it. So what do you think of that?
Well, I see that you're irritated by it. And I was thinking, this is a common theme in Finning's Wake. He approaches every new technology and has HCE reacting to them, pro and con. He has four views constantly going on. So we have this Facebook. Is this a big problem? Does this undermine the Marxist agenda? Does it undermine the fascist agenda? Does it make people totally silly and useless? Or is it just a passing thing? There's the very question. I don't how to look at this complaint from Ben. I don't do Facebook myself. Someone registered me somehow, and so there is a Bob Dobbs thing there, and people post on it, but I hardly ever respond. But I do check out some that Gamma, who keeps sending me every day a new friend, and I'll click on it, confirm their friend, and see who it is, but I won't spend much time there. And so it's a strange thing where I have become LinkedIn with a lot of Facebooks, but I don't engage it.
So you're doing all the linking.
In this world, but not of this world.
You're doing all the linking without doing the work. You know, you're,
yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm just, we have to go over here now. Okay, I'll go over there. Yeah. I'll get along.
Yeah.
But I'm faking it. I'm not involved.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Here's a new technology. It's a big deal. A lot of people do it. They now do Twitter. Do you know what that is?
Yeah. I was talking to Sean Bonney, the poet, and he's enthusiastically Facebooking and produced some guy he went to school with at a concert I went to yesterday, found through Facebook. But he says Twitter's beyond him. He's tried it, and it's just the comments that you put in have to be so short, he can't get around it.
Yeah, because a lot of people like the shortness, and then they get quick comments from people, but people say, okay, I just got out of the bathroom, I'm going to have some chipmunks now, and then they an hour later report something else. I mean, can you imagine what silly state of mind you have to be in to report what you're doing to nobody, because who's reading you? Maybe one friend. It is an example of living in nowhere land.
This
Facebook.
Yeah, but isn't this the thing that we have to fight? I mean, which you fight by walking down the beach and looking at the or swimming and looking
and mentioning to the beach bum there, have you read chapter 4 of Finnegan's Wake?
Yeah, but also one of
the speaking Spanish or something.
The points that you make, you bring up one of your McLuhan-esque bodies that you're in, that a lot of our alienation is not being able to actually enjoy the life we're living because it's not represented by something, and a feeling of that you're sitting in a beautiful park, but what's the point, because it's just you and you're not on your mobile telling somebody I'm sitting in a beautiful park. Until you've and in effect what that is, until you've paid somebody, because the reason why BT, British Telecom, coined the slogan it's good to talk isn't because they think it's good to talk at all, it's because they think it's very good to pay to talk. You're paying somebody to talk, and what interests me about the discussion we're having now on Skype is we're not paying to talk because it's a free service.
It's a free service. Long live Skype.
And I'm aware that it's selling telephone stuff, but that doesn't affect me because I don't have a mobile phone. But the business of
go onto the beach every day.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, it is a subset. People are reading books, at least in the summer. Mm. Everybody, all the beauties are on there bathing in this amazing beach, and they're all reading. And I have to hold myself back from walking around. I'm a seething ball of frustration as I before I get in the water, where I want to knock the book, the stupid bestseller, on the head and say, look at this radio program, and hand him Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
Okay? So I'm doing the work. I'm there controlling myself, but I'm thinking and seething and eating. And that's me responding to the present. I'm still trying to, hey, let's check you out. Can you really read? Look at this.
Yeah.
Have you done that to people? Well, can you read that page? Page 3 of Finnegan's Wake? And then they start to read it. They collapse.
Yeah.
They fail. I say, see, you can't read.
Full of stains, full of metals, full of black blobs, grows arctic, toad labens, some garment guy, insects appalling, low hum, clang, sin, a cheap decoy, too deep destroy, say manga graphic, may say nay, poor daguerre. Photography.
And then if they all were reading Finnegan's Wake when I went down there next time, I would shove The Art of Being Ruled in their face immediately. I would switch to Lewis allegiance.
Yeah. Yeah. but the reason I brought up the beach was this, realizing that it's taken a certain amount of maturity, and maybe or it's been a battle in my life about getting rid of my super, what Freud would call the superego, or the sense of what is cultural as being real, the inversion of life, culture as life. I mean, this is a situationist argument that the idea that only when you're talking on the mobile phone, or that you're communicating via Facebook or on the computer, that you are real, and that when you are not communicating via any of those means, but you're sitting and staring out the window, that is a miserable nothingness. Whereas I think that's an inversion, and that I agree with Adorno, who talked about wanting to lie in the water doing nothing like a beast. And when I look at animals in the zoo who are doing nothing and they're not bored because they're being the animal, for me there's something wrong with our species being and our way of communicating, that we're pressurized into thinking that that's not life, whereas that in fact is the life that we have, that isn't very long, and we're not going to have it forever. And that's the point, that is the amazing thing. We don't swear on this, so I can't quote the Zappa quote, but it's effing great to be alive. And reaching that point where you realize that real life is the point, not all these representations of it, which is what the money system doesn't want you to have, because it doesn't make money. Money is a representation. So being obsessed with money all the time is being obsessed with a representation. And realizing representations are representations of something which is real, which is your life, which is has a terminus, and we need to live it, is to me the revolutionary idea that I want to communicate to people.
And we only have a minute or so left?
Yeah.
What do we have?
In fact, we're 2 minutes overdue.
All right. Well, so I want to just say this, then end.
Yeah.
Conventionally, all Facebook dupes must deal with such separable problems as the correlation of the final creation to reality, the authenticity of the creative experience, and the manipulation of human reactions, and concentrate throughout the artistic process on formal unification, while also focusing on the possibility of introducing what in historical context will somehow contain novelty. Whether reality is rendered through imitation or is introduced anew, if it is to be measured for its viability, art is reduced to a dry empiricist epistemology, and so is Facebook.
And who said that? You?
I'm quoting Richard Meltzer, The Aesthetics of Rock.
Okay, we'll end with Meltzer. Thanks, Bob. Bye.
Bye.